Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. We're quite excited today, Alex. Who have we got on?
Oh, we owe our guest one today, Alina. We have Zach White with us, Napoleonic historian, who has respectfully sat through all of the insanity and the shenanigans of our Sharp Reunion podcast, interjecting in on the lunacy with some historical fact when he can. So it's about time he got his own podcast to talk about his stuff. So of course he's going to do Peninsular War with us, but in particular we're going to look at Crime and Punishment, which sounds really juicy. How are you, Zach?
I'm good, thanks very much for caring. How are you both?
Yeah, we're all right. We've kind of had enough of lockdown now.
Agreed.
Yeah,
slight agree. Understatement. Brilliant. Well, just tee us up before we start talking about the Crime and Punishment with explaining to laymen what the Peninsular War is and how Britain got involved and where.
Yeah, this is probably quite a good starting point because for a lot of the public, and this was certainly true for me, people tend to come into contact with this period through the Sharps novels, which is great, but doesn't necessarily help you to pick up the context. The Peninsular War is a smaller element of the Napoleonic Wars, which really start in the 1790s with war with the French Revolutionary Government, and then continue after Napoleon took control. And the Peninsular War itself lasted between 1808 and 1814. But its origins go back to 1807, when Napoleon was at the height of his power, and he tried to effectively suffocate his last remaining enemy, which was Britain, through a continental blockade, effectively depriving the country of trade in order to force it to agree to his peace terms. And part of that required Portugal to adhere to it, because the only way this was going to work as a system was if the entire continent effectively shut its borders to British commerce. But Portugal couldn't really afford to do that because they were exporting huge amounts of wine to Britain. Even back then, we drank loads. And their refusal led to Napoleon saying, well, look, here's an ultimatum. You either do what I say or I'm going to invade you. The Portuguese still refused, and so Portugal was invaded. But then in the process of doing that, particularly over the course of 1808, as more and more troops get sent across Spain in order to invade Portugal from the south of France, Napoleon started to look at how weak the Spanish monarchy was, and effectively decided to stab Spain, which was his ally, in the back. Unsurprisingly, the Spanish objected to him trying to forcibly remove the Spanish monarch and set up his own kind of puppet regime in Spain. And so there was an uprising in Madrid, which is known as the Dos de Mayo Uprising, which was captured particularly vividly by a guy called Francisco Goya in a sequence of paintings. And although the uprising was crushed and there were executions of some of those involved on the following day, which again was captured by Goya, there was a chain reaction across the country, as some, not all, but significant numbers of people within the country rose up against these occupying French forces. And Spain turned around to Britain, their former enemy, and a sort of marriage of convenience ended up forming, with the Spanish initially asking for money, arms and ammunition. But the British also decided to divert an army under Arthur Wellesley, the future Duke of Wellington, which had been destined for Venezuela, actually, a Spanish colony. And that landed in Portugal at Mondego Bay in August 1808. It was a small force by the scale of armies at the time, so only about 14,000 men. And by the end of the month, it had beaten France twice at Releça and Vimeiro, and effectively liberated Portugal before Wellington was, well, Wellesley as he was then, was superseded. And over the next 6 years, the war ebbed and flowed across the Iberian Peninsula, which is why we call it the Peninsular War. In January 1809, Wellesley's successor, John Moore, was forced to pull a massive chunk of the army out of the region altogether at Coruña. Portugal was then reinvaded by Wellesley, who was sent out again in April 1809. He liberated Portugal in 6 weeks. And then a stalemate sort of developed, particularly in the wake of the Battle of Talavera in July 1809, which is where he's promoted, he's given his lordship to become Wellington. Because the issue ultimately that creates that stalemate is that there are so many French troops in the region. And yes, a lot of those are tied down by the Spanish guerrillas, the insurgent forces who some are kind of motivated by patriotism, others are just bandits. But the fact that you've got these bands of people across the country who rise up against the French means that the French send a lot of troops into the region. It's estimated that somewhere in the region of 250,000 French soldiers are tied up trying to firstly subdue Spain itself, but also force out the British, which they can never ultimately do. In 1812, there's a bit of a breakthrough, partly because Wellington received gradual reinforcements, and at Salamanca, he manages to secure a comprehensive defeat over one of the French forces. That's followed up in 1813 at Vitoria, when the French are forced out of Spain altogether, and the Anglo-Portuguese-Spanish army, which Wellington commanded by that point, was the first force into France in late 1813, invading in the south. And the war is important for a few reasons. Firstly, it creates this unbroken string of victories over the French, with the exception of a siege at Burgos in 1812. And that galvanized the whole continent, because it created this sense that actually the French could be defeated. And that was something that wasn't necessarily apparent, because Napoleon had had this long sequence of often stunning victories over the various coalitions that had formed against him. And so the fact that Britain had been able to secure this sequence of victories out in Spain and Portugal sent the message that it could be done, and that helped to kind of boost the morale of the continent as a whole. It also, as I mentioned, drew 250,000 French troops into the conflict, which could have been put to better use by Napoleon elsewhere if he hadn't been trying to subdue Spain and Portugal. But it also allowed Britain to hold its head high, not just because prior to this point, Britain's main role in the conflict against Napoleon had just been bankrolling other armies, but the fact that Britain had been able to take the fight themselves to Napoleon meant that they had that extra bit of clout when it came to negotiating, trying to bring other countries into the conflict. And it helped to build the reputation of the British army, because before that point, it hadn't been particularly great. But the fact that they've been able to defeat what was considered to be the best army at the time in the form of the French army meant that actually people started to rate the British force in a way that they hadn't before this point.
Let's talk a bit more about what the British army was comprised of. So where did the British army recruit from? What was the makeup of the units in the Peninsular War, and what was life like for them?
Yeah, one of the big contradictions between about the success of the British army over the French is that this isn't a conscript force that Britain recruits, but it's also unlike the French army, which is comprised of conscripts. But it's also, the British army is quite old-fashioned in its methods. It's an ancien régime army. It's split by class. So you've got the officers, who are often aristocrats and gentry, and they gain their position, and Wellington's an example of this, by buying their ranks. So you physically pay for initially your ensignship, and then you pay more and more for each rank that follows. And then beyond that, it's promotion based on competency. But it's completely different to the French system, which is based on promotion because you've done a good job. And there's an irony in the fact that this old-fashioned, outdated, pretty backward force in terms of thinking about who's best equipped to lead is able to defeat a much more egalitarian, much more forward-thinking French army. When it comes to the rank and file of the British army, Wellington famously called them the scum of the earth, which is one of his sort of classic exaggerations. And it said that many enlisted for drink. There's something in that. Some men did come from prisons because there was an option that rather than face your punishment, you could be drafted straight into the army. But many actually enlisted because they were starving. So when you look at the former professions of these recruits, they're quite often labourers who have enlisted because they need a meal and because they need regular pay. And with fluctuations in the British economy over the period, the spikes in recruitment often come at the times when there are economic hardships. And everyday life is quite dull, as it is for most soldiers even now. Battles the exception rather than the rule. Those battles were fought at incredibly close quarters. The common weapon, the musket, had a range of 80 yards. The rifle, for sharp fans, was much further. It was 300 yards. But even so, you could see the enemy close up. And at times, not unusually, there was hand-to-hand fighting. So it ended up being quite vicious when it did come to a fight. If you were wounded, well, good luck was basically the message from your surgeons, because infection was a massive, massive problem. If you broke a limb, amputation without anaesthetic was your most effective option. And even then, because hygiene levels were so poor, the chances of you surviving that were... PTSD was obviously an issue, but it wasn't recognised at the time. And you have a number of trials of individuals, and you can see in the court proceedings that what they're suffering from is post-traumatic stress disorder. But because there was no concept of that at the time, what they end up being tried for is things like cowardice. Day to day, their biggest problem was a lack of food. And it's another irony of the system. These people often enlist because the army is meant to guarantee their pay and guarantee them a meal a day. But the army was often months in arrears out in the Iberian Peninsula. And that meant that troops couldn't buy food. But nutritionally, even the food that they were meant to get, often they didn't get that, was woefully inadequate for the task they had to do. A chap called Ed Koss, in a book, All for the Living Shilling, did a really detailed study of nutritionally, what's the calorie intake, and how did that compare to their calorie burn. And effectively, they were starving themselves in terms of what they had to do, particularly because of those massive supply issues, and Wellington would rage about the fact that people weren't able to get the supplies as fast as they were needed. But the fact that they were starving meant that they had to plunder, because it was plunder or die. You had to do something in order to be able to eat. But if you got caught, the punishment for that was potentially execution. And so it created this vicious cycle for them, where they had to try and navigate this really ambiguous, really dangerous line between how do you get hold of food in order to be able to actually not die, but at the same time not get caught in the process in order to be able to eat and not be executed for committing a crime. The other issue that they have is disease, because at any one point in the conflict, up to a third of Wellington's force was in hospital. So it's a pretty horrendous life for the soldier.
I'm really keen to know, before we start to talk about your research, tell us, how have people generally understood crime and punishment to work in this period in the army?
It's seen as pretty severe. It's probably worth me outlining kind of some of the slightly geeky constructs of how the system worked. So initially, in the period that I'm looking at, there are two levels of court, and then from 1812, there's a third level. At the top, you've got the general court-martial, which is meant to deal with the really serious stuff. So things like murder, mutiny, desertion, that hands out the most serious punishment. So it's the general court-martial that can sentence you to execution or transportation overseas. At the bottom, you've got the regimental courts martial, which, as the name suggests, is dealt internally within the regiment. And that's for the much more minor stuff, things like drunkenness, dirtiness. And they hand out much more minor punishments. But then from 1812, you have the creation of something called the general regimental court martial, which, as the name implies, is meant to sit in the gap between the two. It's kind of intermediate tier. The main punishment at this point is flogging. The general courts martial, the top tier, can sentence someone to 1,500 lashes, 1,500 lashes, which will kill you. It'll turn your back into
I'm guessing you'll be dead halfway there. Well, less than halfway there. Isn't a dozen considered quite harsh?
There's an interesting debate between people who've looked at crime and punishment in the Navy and the handful of people who kind of think about army punishment. And the naval historians like to suggest that actually being flogged for 12 lashes in the Navy is really severe, because you're being flogged by the bosun. And they turn around and say, yes, but in the army, the flogging is done by drummer boys, and so therefore the lash hurts less. But actually that's a misconception, because a chap called Erin O'Keefe, who specialises in things like military music, has started to look at the actual age of drummer boys. And what he's found is that actually these guys are teenagers, sometimes like late teens, 18, 19, 20 even. And so that disparity doesn't actually exist in the way that it's thought of. In terms of whether it would kill you when you were halfway there, well, what's really interesting is that the 1,500 lash punishment isn't actually ever handed out. There are a couple of times where it's sentenced, but then it's not inflicted. They change it to something less vicious. Yeah. But what they do hand out is 1,200 lash punishments, which is still absolutely horrendous. If you passed out partway through, though, which for obvious reasons you would do because of the pain, because of the blood loss, what would potentially happen is that you'd be taken down because you're tied up to this tripod and they flog you. You'd be taken to a hospital, allowed to recover, and then you could potentially, weeks later, be tied back up and receive the remainder of your punishment. So even if you passed out, it wasn't necessarily a get-out clause. And it was widespread. I mean, I've looked at nearly 9,500 cases that cover the period 1808 to 1818. I've put together this sort of database of who's tried when, for what crimes and the punishments they get. And the army issues 2 million lashes over the 11 years that I've looked at. And when you consider that alongside Wellington's pretty uncompromising...
That is insane.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge number. And when you consider that that's divided down across just 9,500 cases, less than that even, and my database doesn't cover everything that was tried by a long way, there's probably 11,000 cases that I haven't even factored in yet. The numbers are, it just blows the mind. And when you put that alongside these really uncompromising orders that Wellington issued at times when plundering had happened, where he basically rants about how this behaviour cannot be tolerated and he won't stop until he finds the culprits and that they will face the full force of the law. And he reminds them that if a group of plunderers are found, there's always one who ends up grasping on the other, and he will exploit that in order to make sure that he has the evidence in order to be able to try them fully. All of which he has to do, it's worth bearing in mind. The reason he makes those threats is because he has to keep the local population on side. He has to tread a very fine line between diplomacy and the reality of what he's dealing with out in Spain and Portugal, because the Spanish are his allies. And he can't have his men plundering, because that's what the French are doing. The French are stripping the country there. And there are brutal reprisals by the Spanish through the guerrillas, the insurgent forces that end up attacking and waging this really vicious war against French supply chains, isolated bands of French units. And Wellington knew that he couldn't afford to have that happen with his force. If he did, the war was over. There was no way that he could fight the French in Spain whilst also dealing with the Spanish. And when you put all of that all together, that Wellington's evident and genuine fury, he was genuinely furious about these incidents. When you add that to the scale of the punishments, the size of them, the number of lashes that are handed out, from one perspective, it looks, for pretty obvious reasons, to be a totally vicious, inflexible and intolerant system. And a guy called Roger Norman Buckley describes it as a system that was based on terror and torture as public spectacle.
You don't agree with how people have interpreted, do you? Do you? No. So you are you saying that you don't agree that it's arbitrary and cruel?
Yeah, I have a quite a different take on it. I mean, okay, there's no getting away from the fact that Buckley is right when he says that the focus was on deterrence rather than reform. But the reality I find is that the things are more complex than that. There's a lot going on in the background that has been overlooked because no one studied it in depth. I mean, a couple of people have articles here and there, but this is the first time that the system's really been sort of picked apart and scrutinised. And through this database that I mentioned, which doesn't cover every punishment that was inflicted by any means, and as I said, there's no getting away from the figures that I mentioned, what does become quite clear is that different sections of the army have really massively different priorities, and they respond to this system and exploit it and manipulate it in really different ways. So at the top, you've got the king, the commander-in-chief, and even parliament, which try and push this humanitarian agenda. The king, early on in this period, is he has to confirm every court-martial, general court-martial that is completed. And they get laid before him, and he looks at one that has a sentence of 1,500 lashes, and he turns around and issues a directive that says that, in his opinion, 1,000 lashes is quite enough to ever be inflicted. That doesn't change the law. And what you find is that actually that's ignored on multiple occasions because it's not a direct order from the king and it doesn't change the fact that there is a system of law that this is all built around. In 1812, the commander-in-chief does a similar kind of thing, but he issues an explicit order when it comes to regimental courts martial, that Boston tier of court, to say that the maximum number of lashes that can be inflicted needs to come down. It was 500, and he insists that it will now be 300, which does something to ease the extent of floggings. But the fact is that the army still flogs a hell of a lot, and 300 lashes is still horrific, and it's issued plenty of times. And then you've got the Mutiny Act, which is the legal basis for this. The courts martial are only able to operate because there is a legal framework that empowers them to have the jurisdiction that they have, because you can't just arbitrarily punish people and tie them up and flog them. And that act is debated every single year in Parliament. It goes back to the fact that during the English Civil War, you have massive issues with a standing army. And so Parliament was always very, very concerned about there being a large established force that wasn't scrutinised annually. So the Mutiny Act is debated every single year. And when you read those debates in Hansard, what becomes quite clear is that there are factions within Parliament that are trying to abolish flogging altogether. And that's a reflection of society, because thinking within the civilian legal system was changing in terms of how people thought about crime and punishment. You get a transition from people being obsessed with punishing the body through flogging, through capital punishment, to punishing the mind by putting people in prison, transporting them overseas. And there are elements of Parliament that want to push that agenda and make it apply to the army, although they never actually achieve that. So that's what's happening at the top. Then you get what I call a middle tier, which is the commanders on the ground, people like Wellington, who need to make a quick example of people in order to maintain discipline and then be able to move on. And they're, for pretty obvious reasons, less interested in this idea that actually, perhaps you should lock people up rather than flog them. Because if you lock somebody up, you've got to waste them guarding them. Those individuals can't be used in the front line. The army needs to move on mentally. It needs to take an example of people, but it also needs to move on geographically. And if you're leaving hundreds of people behind the lines because they're locked up in prison and you've got people who are guarding the prisoners, it creates a massive headache and reduces the size of the force that he can bring to bear against the French. So what you see is that not only is the king ignored, but when that middle tier that I mentioned, the general regimental courts martial, is brought in, it's not brought in to make general courts martials be tried in a less severe way. It's actually just used to punish loads more men. And you see huge numbers of people going through the general regimental courts martial from the second it's introduced. But you have another layer within the army kind of social circle, which is the regiment. And at the regiment, it's a massively different story, because officers on the ground in the regiment have another balancing act that they need to implement, which is a balance between the morale of the troops and then maintaining discipline. And what you therefore find is that the officers within the regiment end up pardoning punishments. They pass certain crimes off as lesser crimes. So, for example, things like desertion will just be described as absent, because that's a less serious crime. It could be dealt with in a smaller tier of court and has a less serious punishment attached to it. And more than that, they end up turning a blind eye to a huge number of crimes, particularly when it comes to plunder for food. So I've taken to calling this whole system a pragmatic system of discretionary justice, which is basically a case of flog when you really have to, but when you don't, just don't punish at all.
How did you get onto this topic?
It goes back. It's been a long time in the pipeline. It goes back to my MA thesis, which I was doing back in 2014. I was looking at morale. I wasn't actually that focused on crime and punishment. I was looking at court martials to try and see if they showed anything about morale, which basically they didn't. When I got to a particular point in the records, it was from the siege of Badajoz in April 1812. And for the people who perhaps aren't familiar with what happened there, it was a really unpleasant siege. The city was stormed in early April of 1812, and it was a vicious assault. There are estimates of about 4,000 British troops killed in trying to take the place in a really confined area, most of them dying in the breaches. And in the 48 hours that followed that, army officers completely lost control of their men. they literally ran riot, plundering, setting fire to houses, but also in a number of cases, murdering and raping some of the inhabitants. And so obviously this was a major incident. And I expected, pretty logically, to see loads of trials. And it's what you expect, right? You use total control of the men. You need to punish them to bring them back in line and say, you're not going to do that again. But the reality is that there weren't any. They just weren't there. Men quite simply got away with it. And as you can imagine, it's one of those moments when I sat back in the archive, and we all had these, and your head just starts to explode slightly. And you think, what the hell's happening here? And so I tried to work out what was actually happening. If something like that didn't get punished, what was getting punished? And why weren't they punishing for things like what happened at Monmouth? And so here I am, years later, finishing off a PhD on it.
You've talked about officers using some discretion. Are they in on any of this bad behaviour? I mean, if the army has constant problems with money and that, it's not only the men that are going to suffer, is it?
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting because it contradicts our assumptions about these honourable gentlemen officers. Because like I said at the start, this is an army that is split in terms of class, and the officer class is meant to be staffed by gentlemen. And it ends up being really controversial. Not least because, I mean, this is a town that's occupied by the French, but it belonged to Spain, who was Britain's ally. And when it comes to Badajoz, some did try to stop it. It's worth saying that. There's a lot of talk among historians about whether this was just kind of the expected. And so officers looked at what's happening and went, oh, it's men being men. They've had to assault this city. It's to be expected. It's all accounted for in the rules and honours of war. But I have a few problems with that interpretation, partly because this notion of sacking cities is kind of a 16th century concept. It's quite outdated by this point. In the 18th century, fortresses usually surrendered when a breach, a hole in the fortress wall had been knocked out. And that was part of this whole kind of Age of Enlightenment and not wanting to waste lives in needless slaughter by storming a city. And if you didn't surrender after a breach had been made in the outer wall, then it was the garrison rather than civilians that should be executed when the fortress was captured. Now, Napoleon puts a stop to that because he ordered his commanders not to surrender fortresses without fending off at least one attack. And so it created this unique situation of an allied town being occupied by the enemy. And so I don't really buy into what people have said there. But with some of the officers, it's quite clear that they thought, you know what, it's just best not to get involved. Some who do try and get involved end up being killed by the men for it. And you get, there are some accounts of officers who are trying to sort of hold their men back from plundering. And there's one guy who recalls how one of these soldiers just turns around, brings his musket up and tries to shoot him in the face. And because the musket wasn't loaded, he survived. And he ends up decking the man in question, who apologizes and runs away. But for others, there were certainly some who thought...
insane.
No, it was nuts. And there were plenty of officers who must have been bayoneted by their men. For others, there were certainly some who thought that reward was necessary, partly because the assault was so vicious, and the fact that they nearly didn't take the town, it was that bad. But some actually lined their pockets, and I think this is what has really slipped under the radar. There is a culture amongst some of the officers of just taking things, whether it's from plundered towns like Badajoz, or there's just little things that they see lying around and they think, oh yeah, that'll look nice back home, I'll take that with me. And you get these accounts in the wake of Badajoz where people have gone behind the lines and they're trying to sell off things like gold cups and other stuff that they've plundered, or they send it straight back home to their friends. And there are some really interesting letters where those back home are saying, well, what are you doing sending me this stolen stuff? Why do I want these stolen plays or this stolen collection of books or whatever? And they don't understand the different kind of set of principles that has taken root amongst the officer corps. So it's not necessarily that they don't know how to handle it. It's more that they either think that it's not the time and the place, or they're just busy gathering what they can and profiting from the situation.
This is just something I had never even considered. So we had a good laugh and a joke with Sean Bean, didn't we, about looting, because there were some scenes in Sharp and about Sean Bean's own looting off the set, which he did say he got permission for everything that he took, but he's basically got half the set. But you mentioned people being punished in other ways. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, this is where the pragmatism and the discretion really gets interesting. Because with Sean and Jason, I mean, hopefully people have listened to the podcast, but if they haven't, go and listen to it. I mentioned something in that episode about company courts-martials, which are quite shady because they don't actually have a legal basis. There's no legal provision with them because military law is meant to be dictated by the Mutiny Act, and there's nothing about these in the Mutiny Act. And so they're effectively a court of honour for the rank and file. So the example I mentioned with Sean and Jason was dirty soldiers being scrubbed within a horse trough. So there's this guy who he hasn't been washing, he's being told to, he keeps not bothering. And so the men come together. Rather than him go to a regimental court martial, be flogged for it, they go, "We're not having this." They all get together, say, "Yeah, he's guilty, he should be clean." And they collectively bundle him in a horse trough and they scrub him until he's red raw. And he doesn't do it again. And that, for them, that solves the issue and they can move on.
It's not the same principle as, I wrote a book on Eton, the older boys being allowed to, back in the day, flog the younger boys and letting them dispense their own justice to an extent. Because if it was all, like you say, there's an exact correlating one in there about a boy who didn't wash enough and he stank. So in the end, the older boys stuck him in a bath and scrubbed him clean and he never did it again. It's similar, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's to do with the connections on a personal level, because these are comrades. And for them, group camaraderie is everything. And there are expectations in the army. You know, you have to fulfill a certain job. And if you're not prepared to do basic things like scrub yourself clean, can we really trust you to stand in a battle and keep fighting? Because the whole point of battle tactics during this period is you stand on a line and you fire at the enemy and you charge as one. And if you can't trust the person standing to the right of you, because he doesn't even bother to wash, so does he bother to look after his musket? Has he got the moral fiber to stand in a fight? They have to have this way of dealing with the little things in order for the bigger things to fall in place. And so it must have been not quite the same thing at Eton, because obviously they're not having to fight the war. But there's still that camaraderie there. You know, there are expectations and you need to toe the line. And if you're not, then there's going to be punishment for it. And we don't necessarily need to take you to the officer or the teacher and have you punished in a really serious way for it. But we still expect you to not behave like this. And there are other things that they punish. So for example, there's an account, and these accounts are sketchy, but there's an account of one guy who burns, he's chosen as the cook on a journey on a transport out to I think it's North America, and he burnt their food. And so rather than just kind of put up with it, what they do is they form this company court martial, they decide he's guilty, and they form two lines, and he has to walk up and down the two lines in slow time whilst they're all smacking him over the head repeatedly with their forage caps. Again, you know, that thing of, well, don't do it again. Some of them are a bit more sinister, though. There's a really interesting, I'm not entirely sure if this is true, of a biter, somebody who in fights is just turning around and biting his opponent. And they decide that that's not appropriate behavior. And he's sentenced to having his front teeth knocked out. And the reason that I don't entirely believe this account is because, yeah, I know, pretty horrendous. The reason I don't entirely believe this account is that apparently it was meant to be done by one of the men, and then he bottled it. And so rather than him do it, they called on the battalion surgeon. The battalion surgeon turned around and said, actually, if you want to do this properly, it'd be much better to take all of his teeth out of the bottom jaw rather than his four front teeth. But if they'd done that, he then wouldn't have been able to bite open the powder cartridges to load his weapon. So I'm not entirely sure that one's true. But what's interesting is just the fact that there is talk about these kinds of punishments. And what's really intriguing is when you start to look at how the regiments use that illegal tier of court. Because every 6 months, the regiment was inspected by a general who had to write a report. And from 1812, those reports had to include a list of all of the regimental courts and martials that had taken place. And the issue for regiments was that if there were too many, then the general would comment on this and it would reflect badly on the regiment. And he would say things like, other methods, in inverted commas, need to be used because the court martials are too frequent. And so when you look at the standing orders that are published by certain regiments, it's worth bearing in mind, these are public documents, right? They are published. Anybody can get their hands on them. They explicitly say that company courts martials, which aren't legal, should be used instead of regimental courts martials where possible in order to try and keep the number of trials down, because it benefits the regiment. It improves their reputation because it looks like they need fewer trials to keep order within their units, because the company court martials don't have records kept for them, whereas the regimental court martials do. It also then boosts that honourable reputation because everybody gets a kind of sense that actually you want to be in this particular regiment because their discipline is really on point. And so there's a really interesting complex game going on where officers are sort of deliberately doing things that are illegal in order to make the legal system work that bit better.
Can I ask you about a crime that's particularly yuck, but mm-hmm. it must have happened? Rape. Yeah. There must have been. If there's all this sacking, looting, plundering, people's blood is up and that. Were there cases of rape? What have you found about sex crimes in the army at this time?
Yeah, I mean, it's really depressing to say this, but the attitudes are typically sort of 19th century, to be honest with you. The army hardly ever prosecuted rape. Of the 9,500-ish that I've looked at, I've come across two rape trials. And those punishments are really, really small, sort of 500 lashes. When you consider that desertion and theft could often get at least 1,000, it really speaks volumes about how the army thought about this. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's, well, pretty obviously, it doesn't mean that it's not happening. That's not to say that it was happening every single day, but there's no doubt in my mind that there are massive issues with sexual assault. Even some of the officers' accounts are really blatant about how they're objectifying women, how there's this assumption that there's sexual interest, and it just must have happened. What's also quite telling is that there are only two cases of child abuse, which also must have been happening on a huge scale. Well, not necessarily a huge scale, but it must have happened. But
again, you've got camp followers, haven't you, and things. There are lots of children around.
Exactly. And this sense of not taking rape trials seriously is actually a reflection of society. It's not unique to the army, because rape cases weren't taken seriously in civilian courts. Even when it came to child abuse, you've got these assumptions about women being naturally promiscuous and all of these really vile questions about, you know, how can she prove that she wasn't interested and why wasn't she able to get away? And you even see this
Leander Talar was talking to us about sort of the historic principles behind this on our Anne Boleyn podcast, and about how it was just generally assumed and not at all yuck to consider that women were just sort of these randy, uncontrolled sex maniacs who couldn't help themselves.
Absolutely. And men would use that in their defense. You even see this with child abuse cases in civilian courts. This doesn't apply to the military, but there is these horrendous cases where one particularly springs to mind, where this something like 11, 12 year old child has been sexually assaulted by this bloke, and she's got venereal disease because he's got venereal disease. And so a doctor has examined her and says, look, I can see that they've got the same infection, but he's able to get off of the charge because he comes up with this insane suggestion that she was inherently promiscuous and that she somehow seduced him. It was a massive issue in terms of how people thought about sex crime to women. And what's really telling is that you actually see more trials for homosexuality. I've got 13 of those within my sample. And the language, perhaps as you might expect for that period, is massively value-laden. So they talk about it being an unnatural crime or a beastly crime.
But that's only when to rape a kid.
Exactly.
Wow.
But that value-laden language is only ever applied to the rank and file. We know of instances of officers having been caught in homosexual relationships, sometimes quite uncompromising positions. You know, you've got officers using their position of power to abuse younger members of their units, particularly within the rank and file. And part of the issue with all of this is issues of stigma. So you've got the attitudes towards homosexuality during this period. You've also got issues of stigma associated with rape and obviously the trauma for rape victims. But there's also, out in Spain and Portugal, when we talk about the army, an issue of a language barrier and the fact that the army keeps moving. And so it becomes incredibly difficult for these women to report these crimes because, A, they know that they won't be taken seriously. Secondly, the army's potentially moved on because it happens one night, the army moves on. By the time the victims have the chance to kind of come to terms with what's happened, the army's up sticks and left. But also when you try and communicate with these people, that you can't communicate in their language. So, I mean, I'm not surprised that there aren't many cases of this that get prosecuted, but it's definitely a darker side of the Peninsular War story and the history of the British Army during this period more generally that we've all overlooked.
Mm. You mentioned homosexuality. What crimes do they prioritise then? What are the ones that they consider absolutely disgusting and unacceptable?
Mainly desertion. About 60% of general regimental courts martial were for desertion. About half of all the trials I've looked at are either for desertion or absence without leave. And what you see quite often is massive overlap. So people will be tried for desertion, but actually sort of tried for absence for a period of years. There's one guy I've got who's tried at regimental courts martial, and he's been away from the regiment for 12 years. He's quite obviously deserted, but he's tried for being absent because it comes back to this thing about discretion, whether they really want to publicise the fact that they've got deserters within their unit. What's really weird about desertions in the Peninsular War is that, at worst, they affect about 0.05% of the troops that are out there. So there's this massive imbalance between how big an issue it actually is and what really gets punished. They punish theft a bit as well. That's about 10 to 15% of cases, but that's minuscule in comparison to what must have actually been happening, because the memoirs are packed with these anecdotes of people plundering, whether it's wine, food, or whether in the process of going in search for wine and food, they've come across a couple of coins and they're not going to leave it there for somebody else to find. They're just going to pocket it. For the officers, you've got duelling being one of the most common crimes, which is quite a difficult one. I mentioned Eamon O'Keefe earlier. He's done a lot of work on this. And what he's found is that you're kind of damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Duelling is illegal, so you can't accept a challenge to duel, and you can't kill a man in a duel, because if you do, you'll be tried for murder, or potentially tried for murder. But the failure to accept a challenge to a duel was seen as dishonourable, and you were seen as lacking in your moral character. And so that could lead to trumped up charges about conduct, and you effectively being bullied out of the regiment. But what they're never tried for, officers, is theft, and virtually never tried for murder. And in fact, there's one trial of an officer committing murder, and he's found guilty of manslaughter and receives a fine. So it just says so much about the difference between what officers, what gentlemen are considered to be capable of committing when it comes to crime, and what the rank and file are thought to be doing.
Zach, this has been amazing. You have your own podcast. Tell people where to go if they want to hear more from you.
Yeah, I mean, we should say it's nowhere near as good as this one, okay? History Hack is fantastic. Yeah, my podcast is called The Napoleonicist. It's available on Spotify, Google Podcasts. You can also get it via my website, www.thenapoleonicwars.net. But I'm leading a project to see the remains of six soldiers who were killed during this conflict, during the Peninsular War, which are currently gathering dust in a museum storage unit, analysed and then given a proper burial with military honours, because it looks like they were just left where they fell. They were discovered a few years back and they've just been kind of left there because the museum holding them doesn't have the money to pay for their burial. And we're going to need to crowdfund it. It's going to cost a huge amount of money, something like £20,000. We're not taking donations yet, and I know budgets are really tight at the moment, particularly with what's happening with people losing their jobs due to the COVID crisis. But if people are possibly interested in donating in the future, or if they just want to learn a bit more, they can DM me on Twitter at ZWhiteHistory, or if they go to that website that I mentioned, the napoleonicwars.net, click on the Bones of Burgos tab at the top, they can join a mailing list and stay up to date. So if you might be interested in donating, fantastic. We're not taking money right now, though, because until everything's signed on the dotted line, we're not taking people's money for transparency. But more importantly, if you just want to know more and be involved in the discovery, because it's so rare to find six skeletons of men killed in this conflict, if you just want to hear a bit more about it, then please do join the mailing list and we'll keep you posted on our progress.
Brilliant. Are you going to do a book when you're done with your PhD?
That's the hope. That's a long way off, though, because I'm not quite done yet. I probably won't have this done until about Christmas. So the book will be, 2022, maybe 2023. So it's a long way off, I'm afraid.
Looking forward to it, though. Zach, thanks so much for coming on. You definitely deserved your own spot after listening to all the previous Napoleonic wittering. And just trying to be the sensible one in mayhem, basically.
It was great fun. I mean, I basically got a front row seat to an interview with Sean Bean. And what more can you honestly ask for? So thanks.
You
so
could
much
just retire
me.
Now.
Pretty You're much. Done. I mean, I've reached the pinnacle, haven't I? There's nothing that's going to top that.
He was great fun. Zach, thanks very much.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Join us on Monday when Will Idale will be with us to talk about his book, Kamikaze Hunters. This was incredible. This is the Royal Navy and the last few months of the war in the Pacific. So while everybody else was celebrating VE Day, there's some people still hard at work. And we don't usually think of the Brits as being involved over there, but my God, were they? And he told us all about it, so don't miss that.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.